This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In recent years, Charlotte has become home to the U.S. headquarters of a number of international companies. We're also home to thousands of individuals from around the world who have immigrated here to create a better life or to pursue the opportunity to fulfill a dream. You only have to look to Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools for a snapshot of the impact of all the people from other parts of the world who have chosen to call this city home. There are people from 168 countries speaking 165 languages at CMS. Among the mix of countries who have contributed to our population is South Africa. And today, their number is being augmented by one with the visit to Charlotte of Ibrahim Rasool, ambassador to the United States from South Africa. The ambassador is in town to speak at noon at the World Affairs Council Charlotte at 11:30 at the Westin, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
No, thank you very much, and good morning to everyone.
You actually arrived here yesterday. There's so much to talk about. I'm not exactly sure where to begin, but let's begin here. Why are you in Charlotte? That's a good question.
No, I think that you've mentioned the one overwhelming point, and that is that there's about 5,000 South Africans who have become Americans but retain their identity as South Africans. And I think that as ambassador, we see them as a major resource for South Africa and Africa at its moment when it is rising. And we need to harness their energies in order to give momentum to the African continent's economic prosperity that is taking off as we speak. I also think that it's a very important year to speak to South Africans, as we all have anxieties about Nelson Mandela and his health. And he's the symbol that unites all of us. And so I think people here need to know, South Africans particularly, but also Americans, need to know what we can do to honor him. And then thirdly, I think that I spend a lot of time in Washington, in New York, in places like Chicago, but those are saturated places. I think that we'd like to share the opportunities, the economic opportunities within South Africa and the African continent with people who are more hungry, who are more eager to do business across the Atlantic. And so this brings us to this wonderful place called Charlotte, which I discovered when I visited here last year at the DNC, the Democratic National Convention. I discovered that this was more than just a convention place. This was the home to the headquarters of some of the finest banks. This is probably where the energy revolution is being fomented from. This is really a place bustling with economic opportunity, and that we should find a natural synergy between Charlotte and South Africa.
We talk about all the things you just talked about, like the banking industry and the energy industry, and the fact that we're trying to become an energy capital and a place where new energy the ideas for new energy are incubated and spread across the world. But I don't think those of us who live here necessarily believe it. It's interesting that somebody who came here for 3 days or 4 days for the Democratic National Convention was so quickly convinced that this is actually happening here, and that this is a place of significance. How did you assess the city that quickly?
Within the busyness and the craziness of Charlotte over those 3 days, I joined a panel of ambassadors with the business community of Charlotte. I listened to the mayor speak at the DNC function and so forth. And from the questions that business people here were asking of the Australian ambassador, of the British ambassador and others, and then focusing on the South African case, I think I got the impression that they're looking for new markets. They're not simply looking to bail out a Europe that's in trouble. They're looking for opportunities. And as soon as I had spoken and made the case for Africa and why they should come to Africa via South Africa, I was besieged afterwards by people saying, is it true that South Africa has a policy that says that despite an abundance of coal, you want to have 25% of your energy mix come from renewables? I said, absolutely. And they said, Charlotte, we're doing these kind of things. The technology is here. I think secondly, when I spoke about the need to harness what I think are the underinvested capital in the USA, which we conservatively estimate at about $1 trillion. They said lots of the funds are located in Charlotte. You should be speaking to us. And I made a promise that I'll return. And then, fortunately, I think that this is where the World Affairs Council is just such an absolutely useful instrument for anyone who wants to do economic diplomacy. And that's where we came back to.
I'm curious about the coal the issue that you brought up. If you have so much coal in South Africa, why are you so eager not to use it?
We are going to use it. Mm-hmm. At this moment, two coal-fired power stations are coming out of the ground in South Africa. We're fitting them with technologies for carbon capture, carbon storage and carbon degradation so that we don't send all of it out into the atmosphere. But we're also aware, as last year's president of the COP17, the climate change conference, that we have an obligation. And so we have made a deliberate decision that alongside our coal and our nuclear energy, we will progressively increase the component of renewables as a country. And so we foresee, and this is the opportunity for Charlotte, we foresee that we're going to add 40,000 megawatts of energy over the next 15 years. Mm-hmm. 25,000 of it will be renewable.
Wow, that's a lot. How do you explain this? This is a conversation we've been trying to have in this country for years and with not much success. There's a lot of political infighting over this issue. Why are you forward-thinking in comparison to us, I guess, is the question.
I think circumstances are slightly different in South Africa. Our energy regulator and our energy provider is largely still a state-owned enterprise.
Okay.
Therefore, government policy translates into company policy. Secondly, I think that we have the good fortune that we're only 19 years old as a country. We haven't got two centuries of history behind us. We haven't got two centuries of interests that have determined our future path. And so, in a sense, we used the opportunity 19 years ago to imagine something completely different in South Africa, something which I don't think Americans have. Americans have 200 years of tradition that superintends how they think, what they do, what's important to them. When you've had a fundamental rupture in your society, as the end of apartheid represented, you actually have the opportunity to imagine yourself in a completely different way. And then you can make the kind of decisions that I think South Africa is beginning to make.
You had a long history, personally, with the anti-apartheid struggle. How did apartheid impact you when it was in place?
I think that all South Africans grew up, whether you were white, whether you were in between like I was, colored, or whether you were black. I know colored is a difficult word in the U.S., but yeah, it comes easier off our tongues.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you identify yourself as a colored person.
I think apartheid identified me as as a colored person.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the struggle for identity in the post-apartheid period, we needed to affirm many people who self-identified as colored. And Mr. Mandela reluctantly used the word colored because they did not easily fit into the white space, nor did they fit into the black space. And they had this cultural and linguistic reality that reflected almost coloredness. I think what we are moving towards is to find other identities. And so people like myself begin to identify with my forebears who came there 300 years ago as Malay slaves of the Dutch. So we're finding far more wholesome identities as we move forward.
So under apartheid, as a colored person, not a black person, as a colored person, were you discriminated against?
Look, I think that it starts off at a very young age. In 1972, while in grade 4, I came home one day and found all our furniture in our house in District 6 out on the pavement, my father desperately looking for a truck and for someone to take us to a different place to stay, because the area had been legally declared a white area. And so the most massive forced removals happened. I think that it determined which schools I will go to and what I will be taught. And so there were certain subjects for the vast majority of black South Africans that were just out of reach. Maths and science on the higher grade wasn't for them, because otherwise they'd aspire to stations beyond what was determined for them. And the daily humiliations of where you could swim, who you could marry, who you could socialize with. You could work with a white person only if you are not their superior or their equal. You could not socialize with them, let alone have a relationship with them. I think that which university I went to, I had to find the most obscure university subject that the University of Cape Town taught to make an exception for me not to go to a colored university, which had no medical faculty, which had no science faculty, which was very strong on theology, very strong on education, but no engineering at all. And so I had to find an obscure subject to be able to get a special permission to go to the University of Cape Town. So those were all the ways in which apartheid regimented your life.
This is so much more severe than the Jim Crow. At least it sounds so much more severe than the Jim Crow era that America spent about 100 years in. And you toppled apartheid, although I know it was a struggle to get to the end of apartheid. But once it happened, it happened like that, it seems, to those of us on this side of the ocean. It just happened almost overnight. You had it one day, you didn't have it the next. You had a new country, a new government, a new system. You reimagined yourself. And it seemed to happen relatively peacefully at the end, as opposed to violent struggle at the end. How would you characterize what happened?
I think that we were going through a transition within a transition. We almost needed the Berlin Wall to fall for governments like the U.S. government, run at that point by President Reagan, and the U.K. government, the British government, run by Margaret Thatcher, to de-emphasize their fight against communism and to commit then to human rights. Because up till that moment, apartheid was propped up by the West's overwhelming obsession with toppling communism, and therefore turned a blind eye to the atrocities that apartheid committed against its own people. They chose the strong apartheid army to patrol Africa rather than cede Africa to communism. When the Berlin Wall fell, it coincided with probably the greatest expression of anti-apartheid sentiment that the world had seen. People in America, people in Britain, people all over the world were rising up in revulsion against apartheid, demanding the release of Nelson Mandela. And then you had this special person come out of prison. And seeing the bigger picture, seeing the greater objectives, and subjecting his personal humiliation, subjecting his anger, and subjecting immediate objectives for the bigger ones.
I want to come back and talk about the aftermath of apartheid and about Nelson Mandela and many other things with the ambassador to the United States from South Africa, Ibrahim Rasool. We'll come right back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and 123NC.com, providing North Carolina with instant access to online criminal records for over a decade. Criminal records can be searched online at 123NC.com. And from Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, blood supplier to 21 regional hospitals and thousands of local patients. Every drop stays here, saving local lives. Info about sponsoring a drive at cbcc.us. Well, much of a person's success in life depends on their character. Society is also dependent on the involvement of people of character. But how do you build character in a young person? Well, CMS is partnering with parents and the community to foster honest, responsible, caring students. And there are other private organizations working toward the same end. We'll take a closer look at the process and what's at stake for children, for parents, and for society tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Republican Party controls the House, but has lost the popular vote in five of the past six presidential elections. The future of the GOP.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Ibrahim Rasool. He is the ambassador to the United States from South Africa. He is in town today to speak at 11:30 at the Westin under the auspices of the World Affairs Council Charlotte. There are still seats available. You can go to our website at WFAE.org and find out more information about how to make yourself available for that luncheon today. We were talking before the break about apartheid, the end of apartheid, and how quickly it seemed to occur. I know that you were imprisoned and put under house arrest prior to apartheid for your anti-apartheid involvement in the struggle to remove it. But from Western eyes, from people sitting across this side of the ocean, when it happened quickly, and it happened with very few recriminations. I know that you had the Truth and Reconciliation Council, where people came in and spoke of their grievances, and some of them were horrible grievances. Yet there was no demand for recrimination. There was no demand for punishment. And I found that to be extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. The deal that was made, if I can put it in fairly unsanctified terms, The deal that was made at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was, if the perpetrator stole the truth, the victims would give them reconciliation. And the only condition was full disclosure. And it was important for people to have closure and through disclosure. And so mothers needed to know from the police, is my son dead or is he somewhere in another country in exile? And the torturer would say, I tortured your son to death, and I buried him here. He'd then take the mother or the family to the burial site. And closure was being able to recover the remains and to bury with dignity. And then the mother would consent to amnesty being granted to the perpetrator. And case by case, reconciliation was built. Reconciliation isn't this warm feeling. It is a hard exchange.
Yeah.
It takes a tortured mind to be able to admit to the horrific things that they did in the name of keeping the system going. And that was the genius of Nelson Mandela, and it was the special talent of Archbishop Desmond Tutu to elicit the truth and to help victims and their families to overcome their anger and their bitterness in order to confer amnesty on the perpetrators. And where we found that the perpetrators were not forthcoming with the truth, they are the people who did not get amnesty. Very few of them. But I think it was on that basis that we understood would be the only way for South Africa to go forward.
When you think about all of the conflicts in the world that are based on long historic grudges, some and many of them justifiable, it's curious how you were able to come to this kind of a system, which did work, and why others have not copied you.
I think that it's the model of justice that we walk around with in our heads. Too many walk around with absolute justice as exemplified at Nuremberg. And the Holocaust required a certain form of justice. But you can't get locked into it. In South Africa, we understood justice to be, on the one hand, transitional justice. You needed a justice that took you from the horror where you were to the new imagined society that you wanted. So absolute justice doesn't help. And in much the same way, we needed restorative justice that systematically gave back to those who have been victimized the kind of things that they lost, whether it was the house or compensation for it, or whether it was closure or whether it was their dignity again. And so we had new models of justice.
But for those people who were at the top of the power chain, who lost power as a result of the transition from apartheid to what your country is today, how have they dealt with this? This has to be incredibly difficult, because not only have you opened the society to blacks and colored people and whites equally, you also seem to be on the cutting edge of a lot of other things. You were you became the first African nation recently to legalize same-sex marriage.
We were one of the first nations to legalize it. And that's because when we wrote our constitution, we asked ourselves, what did we miss during the dark night of apartheid? And what we missed was equality, what we missed was dignity, and what we missed was freedom, in that order. And so, you can never admit inequality between people if you've been the victim of it, as a black. And so if you want equality and justice and freedom for blacks, you've got to give it to whites. If you want justice between blacks and whites, you needed to have it between men and women, and therefore you needed to have it amongst people of different religions, and therefore you needed to have it amongst all differences, whether it is sexual orientation or not. It's probably counterinstinctive. If you were to have a referendum in South Africa about same-sex marriages and so forth, you'd probably get the majority of South Africans instinctively not agreeing to it. But that's the value of leadership. It's leadership that understands what you require. What is the liberating vision, and how do you free yourself from your instincts?
Talk about that, because you are a democratic republic. You have elected officials. You yourself were a member of parliament prior to becoming ambassador to the United States. You talk about leadership, and you talk about the public will. If the public who elects you doesn't really care for a policy, but leaders see that the policy needs to happen, whom are you serving?
I think you serve a constitution.
Who are you serving, not whom? I'm sorry.
Yeah. I think we serve a constitution. We are a constitutional state rather than a parliamentary state. And when you have had the chance to accumulate the best wisdom of constitutions across the world, you write the best constitution. Mm. And then you serve it. And whether there are sections of the population who like it or not, the Constitution is supreme. And so, for example, in much the same way that the majority of South Africans would maybe be against same-sex marriages, the majority of South Africans may well be for taking the land away from whites, which they believe was ill-gotten. You've got to protect society from all those instincts. And if leadership is not an autocrat, if leadership is not authoritarian, if leadership is not dictatorship, but is democratically arrived at, and in the case of the African National Congress, almost two-thirds of people voted for them, there is the mandate for the next 5 years for that government to implement the constitution and not fall into populism. I think people fall into populism when the margins are very tight in an election. Then leaders become followers of the public instinct. They do polls, they do surveys in order to try and guess the public sentiment, and then to appear to lead by following the public sentiment, and then second guess the constitution. And we have always maintained that our constitution should be followed more in spirit than in letter. Because we don't want to reduce the Constitution to a fundamentalist game where you become literalist about it, where you become formalistic about it, where you quote it and throw it around like bullets to win arguments. I think you've got to enter it with your full memory of the horror of the past. You've got to read your Constitution. I think societies that have forgotten the context of their constitutions and only have the words today are really societies deeply in trouble and unable to find leadership, calling for leadership, but determining that leadership through their instincts and their passions rather than through their intellect. So I think that those are some of the difficult things that we manage.
I know that you're a diplomat, so I will not get an answer to this question. But when you're referring to those other societies, are you referring to us?
I think amongst others, there are issues that is incomprehensible, that are incomprehensible to South Africans. We've just, for example, on the basis of our constitution's right to life, made some severe amendments to gun laws, where before you can even apply to have a gun, you've got to show that you've been in training for a number of weeks, that you a certificate to show that you are sound of mind, a criminal record to show that you are not involved in any, not even. So anyone, for example, who has ever smacked his wife, we know that with a gun in the house, the smack will become a shot. So if you, and you have to have, listen to this, you have to have your partner, your wife or your husband, co-sign your application for a gun. And you have to have two neighbors co-sign your application for a gun. Now, I think that that's a society that has seen life lost in devastating ways through guns, that now corrects itself. Whereas, I think, a literalist interpretation to the Second Amendment may well mean the right to bear arms.
And yet, and I'm trying to find my notes on this, and I can't seem to find them, you have a really high murder rate in South Africa and a very high rape rate. I think 500,000 people, women, report being raped, and a quarter of the men in South Africa report having committed a rape over the course of their lives. And the UN compiled the report on murders, and South Africa ranks second in that list in terms of people being murdered. How do you account for all that, despite this enlightened gun control approach, if you want to put it that way?
I think many people find it incongruous that we have such a society prone to violence when you've had a saintly Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. I think you couldn't have lived the 300 years of slavery, of segregation, of apartheid, of life being so cheap, of losing children and budgeting, in a sense, to lose children during that apartheid system and not come out of it unscathed. Unfortunately, we haven't found a way to do mass therapy for our country. But our gun laws were particularly a response to that. And I just met with the head of the Medical Research Council's researcher on it. And since the implementation of those gun laws, the number of intimate partner deaths, murders, have decreased. The number of gunshot wounds are decreasing. And the early signs are there. And I'm getting those stats.
Did you take guns away from people? When this law was put into place, did you take guns away from people who could not pass the litmus test that you just outlined?
We've particularly had the removal of assault weapons. That's a general application.
How do you know they didn't hide them and keep them for themselves?
I think that there's a great possibility that those things happen because you couldn't have armed the entire white male community in the army, and you couldn't have had a guerrilla army of the ANC having weapons stashed away and have a guarantee. So there is no. But we have regular ways in which we create amnesty weeks for people actually to come up, put their weapons onto a pile, and without any recriminations from society. So we have regular amnesty weeks for such purposes. Mm-hmm. And so it's an ongoing struggle. These are not abracadabra stuff. These are things that you actually have to win the hearts and minds of people to buy into it.
Ibrahim Rasool is our guest. He is the ambassador to the United States from South Africa. As you say, your nation is only 19 years old, and you have your George Washington still alive. Nelson Mandela is 94 years old. He'll be 95 in July. He has been ill. He's very frail. What do you think the impact of his eventual passing will be on your nation?
I think that you will find a nation, if not a world, in grief. I think it will probably be one of those moments that our nation is bracing themselves for. Mm-hmm. I think it will, ironically, be a moment of unity in grief. That all the things that continue to fracture us from time to time, I think will just dissipate as we all pay tribute. And maybe it will be a moment of resolve to say that his vision and his legacy are going to be very important for all of us to preserve. I don't think that we will see an upheaval because I think we're far too mature. I also don't think that we will see a return to a non-Mandela period because the Constitution is given us. Is just so supreme.
You spoke about your Constitution, I think, on Freedom Day, which is April 27th. That's the day in 1994 where you had the first post-apartheid free elections. And you talked, and you used Thomas Jefferson as an example in the speech that you made, because Thomas Jefferson did believe that our Constitution, the United States Constitution, should be altered from time to time and rewritten, and that there ought to be a constitutional convention to come in every couple of years and just rewrite the whole darn thing, a document that we regard as sacred and untouchable. He said every generation, every 19 years, it ought to be rewritten or looked at. You're 19 years old. Would you want to relook at your Constitution, which you have been praising during this program?
I don't think, in a sense, that our Constitution is failing us. I think that there are certain impatiences which are manifesting. And so while our Constitution guarantees property rights, it doesn't intend to freeze property relations at 1994. It intends for a greater sharing of the land based on fair value or market value. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't had much success in that. And so in a sense, we've had farm workers in the Western Cape rise up against what they see as serfdom on the part of white farm owners in the Western Cape. We've had uprisings in the mines because 19 years later, only 26% of mine ownership, shareholding, has been transferred from a minority to a majority. And so some people have called for nationalization. I think government has taken a far more measured view and say this is not on the agenda. It's old thinking. You can't present old solutions to current problems. So there's, again, the maturity guarding us against our instinct. So maybe it's the Constitution is not the problem. What is the problem is the pace of transformation in year 19. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the great discussion in South Africa at this moment without feeling the need to tamper with the Constitution.
I want to talk about economics and about the economic relationship that your country has with ours when we come back, among other things. Our guest today is Ambassador Ibrahim Rasool, the ambassador from South Africa to the United States. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, introducing the all-new redesigned 2014 Forester, providing more leg room and rear cargo space, a CVT transmission, and up to 32 miles per gallon. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. The Republican Party controls the House but has lost the popular vote in five of the past six presidential elections. GOP efforts to position the party for future success, the topic of the conversation at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation with the ambassador to the United States from South Africa, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, that's 9323, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Then we had a little bit of a struggle getting the live ram into the trunk of the taxi cab.
Tune in for more true stories told live on the Moth Radio Hour. Old-fashioned storytelling about modern life. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Listen in this Friday night starting at 9 at 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Ibrahim Rasool, ambassador to the United States from South Africa. He's been made available to us by the World Affairs Council. He's speaking at their luncheon today at 11:30 at the Westin, and there are still seats available. You can go to our website for details on how to do that. Mohammed in Charlotte writes, what advice do you have for the other apartheid nations around the world ridding themselves of such injustice?
I think that we need to replace justice with injustice wherever it exists. It's going to be important that we don't use a shorthand like apartheid to just apply as a label to get moral outrage going against it. I think it could result in intellectual laziness that you don't think of every situation on its own merits. You've got to understand what is specific about, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It requires justice, absolutely no doubt. To simply say it's apartheid is to then wait for a Mandela to come, and it's very clear neither on the Palestinian side nor on the Israeli side is there the prospect of a Mandela, either lurking in jail or whatever the case may be. And so how do you work, in a sense, with mere mortals to fashion a peaceful solution, a just solution, and an equitable solution in a place like that? I think that there are other places in the world where one also doesn't want to apply the notion of apartheid too easily. So I think going through every situation in the world requires a particular approach. I think that much of it depends on how often the United States behaves and what its intents and interests are. And I think that we're finding the U.S. at the moment, when its population doesn't have the appetite and its fiscus doesn't have the resources to just do foreign adventures. Maybe what that means for us is that the space for dialogue is opening up, and that's all you need. That's what South Africa required, the space for dialogue free of other interests, like the Cold War, impinging themselves on your ability to do it. We need to find ways to grab that space for dialogue wherever we are in the world.
You have held a number of elective offices within your government. You were a premier. Is that the same thing as being a congressperson in this country, or is it something else?
It's equivalent to governor.
A governor, okay. So you were a premier of a particular province of South Africa. I've read that your social and political involvement has always been faith-driven. There are a lot of people in our government who profess their faith rather generously and say that they are faith-driven in their efforts politically. What does that mean to you, to be faith-driven?
I think it's different from being religion-driven. Religion is an adherence to a particular set of rituals, a particular set of interpretations, and a particular community of people who look like you, think like you, pray like you, eat what you eat, etc. In many respects, I do that with a broader Muslim community. But when you get into the realm of faith, you find connections with other people of faith who also struggle every day to define God, who also struggle to make God relevant in the world in which we live. And when you even transcend faith and you identify yourself as a spiritual person, you then get into the areas in which ethical values, spiritual values, begin to define more your actions than adherence to a community and its politics and its theologies and so forth. So the point of the matter is that I think we need to get more and more people to be faithful to their community, but to graduate into faith and even to get that post-grad degree into good spiritual behavior and ethical behavior, because there are some people who are so driven by their religion that they could even contemplate and actually defy the ethical and spiritual values of the God they believe.
You're speaking of terrorists.
Hmm?
Are you speaking of terrorists?
Am I speaking?
Of terrorists when you
I think I speak of terrorists. I speak of fundamentalists all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I speak of of people who believe that it's okay to kill in the name of God to protect their religion, whether they are Muslim terrorists who do suicide bombing, or whether sometimes they have control of armies who are mainstreamed and make decisions to invade and to occupy. And so, in a sense, the only difference between fundamentalist mindsets of that is who has formal power and who has the informal power to do devastating things to other human beings.
You've been involved in the Islamic movement, and you've described yourself, I believe this is accurate, correct me if I'm wrong, as a nonviolent Islamist militant, a non-fundamentalist revolutionary, and a non-extremist radical. Is that accurate?
I think it's absolutely accurate in the sense that the world needs radical change. The world needs transformations. And sometimes there are causes that require militancy. South Africa has shown that being militant doesn't mean being violent. Because you've got, you see, the middle ground often comes across as weak on its issues. It doesn't have the same fervor, the same passion of mobilization that those on the fringes and on the extremes have. And so unless the middle ground is going to defend the precepts and the values and the ethics on which that middle ground stands, and unless it's going to do so militantly, it's going to cede the space. Unless we are going to be radical in our demand for justice here and for a better life there and to overcome poverty and to make sure that the environment is protected, I think we're just going to be mealy-mouthed, weak-kneed people. Mm-hmm. And so I think
But when you have this passion, and for a person who has that passion about whatever the issue is, whether it's religion or politics or economics, whatever it is, when you have that passion, how do you control it so that you try to get your way when the stakes are so high, not to resort to violence, not to resort to terrorism, not to resort to acts against the state to get your way?
You see, the rabbis tell us that the intersection between justice and peace is compromise. Because if you want perfect justice, you're going to have to do it almost at the expense of peace. And if you want perfect peace, you often do it at the expense of justice. And so the perfect compromise is when you have proportional amounts of both. And Nelson Mandela told the African National Congress on the eve of the election, of the negotiations between the African National Congress and its allies and the apartheid government and its allies, if you negotiate, you must be prepared to compromise. We have too many people entering into dialogue, entering into negotiations, but not willing to compromise what they stand on. I think America is seeing the result of that in Congress.
Right.
I think we're seeing the result of that in the Middle East. I think every persistent conflict has leaders who don't have the courage to tell their people about the need to compromise, as Nelson Mandela told us ahead of the negotiations.
How many people in your government think similarly to you, agree with you?
I think that there is no ethical, values-orientated, principled disagreement amongst us. South Africa has a great luxury of negotiating regularly on strategy and almost usually on tactics.
And yet you do have significant challenges in South Africa. You've been through some very tough times in recent years, and despite the fact that you have the fifth highest per capita income of any nation on the continent of Africa, you also have an unemployment rate that is astoundingly high. It's 25%, and that means they live on less than a dollar and a quarter a day. Is that due to the recent recession, or is it due to other factors multiplying over time, or is it due to the end of apartheid and the lingering effects of apartheid?
All of the above.
Okay.
I think that apartheid bequeathed us a functionally unemployable group of people who didn't have math and science, mm-hmm. and therefore couldn't even enter a college or a university or any job in a knowledge-based economy. I think, secondly, we have tried various experiments on how to overcome that. Some have worked, some haven't. In education, I think we're in our eagerness to get the best solutions. We have sometimes made mistakes. And then I think since 2008, the global recession, we've lost a further 1 million jobs in South Africa because European and American companies divesting in order to create liquidity at home. So basically, it's all of the above. And we need to really find ways. And that's what our debates are about. That's what makes our debates passionate. It's not about what it is that we must do. There's principled agreement on that. It is how we do it. And we need to let every idea bloom in South Africa.
Is economic development part of the answer to all of this, finding ways to develop the nation economically? Because I know that when you were the premier of the Western Cape, you brought $1 billion in investment to that area of your country, economically speaking, development speaking, developmentally speaking. Sorry.
Economically underpinned by sound education and good infrastructure, I think is the way that we go forward. And all the signs are there that we can recover economically and that the next generations can find gainful employment, especially as they emerge more and more with math, science, engineering, and all of those kind of issues behind them. However, that's not the end of the story. There's a debate in America that I think is opening up that we have passed long ago, and that is that while you make the transition from a difficult situation to a better situation, you need not only the bridge, but you need a safety net because there are people falling off the bridge of economic development and they need a safety net. When they are ill, they can't be condemned to die or condemned to morbidity. They need a health system that is not only effective but humane. When they get old and can no longer work, they need a public pension system that can keep their dignity intact. When they are young, they must be resisted against the temptation of being taken out of school and forced into some labor just to get an extra few dollars into the household. And so the state effectively subsidizes that child to remain in school for as long as possible. When you have a debilitating illness or disability, you need to still care for a family. And so the state has to, in a sense, step in. Every month, every household gets a certain amount of free electricity and free water simply to stay alive. And so our safety net has improved the household income in South Africa and eased the difference between whether we have ranging violence or relative stability.
And who pays for all that? What's the tax rate?
The tax rate, we've made our tax collection system a lot more efficient, but basically, those earning under about 30,000 rand per annum are exempted from tax. Everyone else then pays a progressive tax rate so that those who are millionaires would come close to over 40%. And the average would be anywhere between 30 and 40% of income earners in South Africa. But we have a culture in which people actually, you know, in South Africa we know that you have the right to try and pay as little taxes as possible, but you don't have the right to evade taxes. That's the culture. And people all know that their taxes are not going to some ethereal entity called the government. They can actually see it being delivered to the poor. And so they see the returns on their investment with greater stability, greater peace.
And you have no arguments about that being a socialistic view of the world?
It's not a socialistic view of the world at all. It is probably far more social democratic view of the world. That's what keeps Scandinavia going without their tax rates. That's where I think the perfect compromise is between needing a society that cares for the most vulnerable and being a society that is only successful for the go-getters. I think there has to be a middle path in between that allows the go-getters to excel but keeps the vulnerable from falling through the cracks.
There's an initiative between our two countries called the South Africa-U.S. Strategic Dialogue, and through that initiative, a South African company recently announced a $21 billion investment in a gas-to-liquid manufacturing facility in Louisiana. That's the single biggest investment in U.S. history and one that will create 8,000 jobs there. How does that help your country with a high unemployment rate when you create 8,000 U.S. jobs in Louisiana?
I think Sasol, who's the company involved, improves its ability to pay more taxes in South Africa. It's effectively able to cross-subsidize its operations in South Africa and to make sure that people don't get unemployed there because of closures, but it also means that there is more that they can contribute to the tax fiscus.
And is there reciprocity? Are we putting jobs in your country?
I think we're seeing a lot more. Ford has opened a plant to do pickups. John Deere now manufactures there. General Electric is manufacturing locomotives. And so I think we're seeing it's a great U.S.-South Africa relationship.
Ibrahim Rasool, the ambassador to the United States from South Africa. I wish we had more time, but we're out of it. Thank you for the hour.
No, thank you very much for the very...
Charlotte talks with...